Hi, friends, and welcome to the 1840 podcast, where each month we explore a different topic balancing modern sensibilities with traditional sensitivities to give you new approaches to timeless Jewish ideas. I'm your host, David Beshefkin, and this month, we're not really exploring a new topic. We're actually on break for January, and instead of just going blank, what we've chosen to do instead is reach into the vault and pull out some of the older topics and discussions and provide a little bit more context and ideas behind them, maybe dust them off and see if we can explore them in a new light. So on today's podcast, what we really want to talk about and discuss is why 1840? What's the story with your name? Many people ask me this all the time, and I always tell them, like, why did you choose the name 1840? My usual response is that we ran out of Jewish acronyms with the letter J, you know, like J-Star, J-Wow, J-Pop, J-anything. We have no more acronyms left with the letter J in. So Jewish institutions, organizations, we need to find something else to call our programs, podcasts, and institutions. The real reason, and it took a lot of explaining when we first started to the people I was working with, they all looked at me like, is this like some Nate Silver, you know, calling a program after a number type of thing? But this number, which is really a calendaric year for 1840, has been a part of my life really before we launched any podcast, before I wrote anything. It really goes back to my early inception where I became connected to the Hasidic world, as many of you have heard on the podcast, of Reb Tzadok. Reb Tzadok, those of you may or may not know, was a Hasidic leader who had kind of these modern sensibilities with traditional sensitivities, as I often say. He was born in 1823 and he died in 1900. He wasn't born Hasidic. He was born like a regular non-Hasidic Jew, and his life quite literally began to fall apart. His marriage fell apart and he started wandering really in his late teens throughout Europe by himself. And he stumbled across this base medrash known as Ishbitz that was run by the Hasidic leader named Rav Mordechai Yosef Liner, who affectionately is known as the Ishbitzer Rebbe. And the school of Ishbitz Hasidus, which is the Rebbe of Reb Tzadok, who I've been enamored with and has animated so much of my thought and ideas and really everything that I do and the life that I choose to live, the Ishbitzer began his Hasidic court, as you're gonna about to hear, in the year 1839-1840, the Jewish calendaric year of Tafresh. The Ishbitzer began his Hasidic court in the year Tafresh, which is the year 1839-1840. And this was not an insignificant year. It was a year in the secular world of a great deal of change where it felt like people were being pulled into this ocean of modernity and this world of figuring out what your identity is. What does it mean to be alive and to contribute to society in this entirely new world? And in the Jewish world, it had special significance because this was the year, as the Zohar writes, which is the 600th year in the 6th millennia, which the Zohar, this Kabbalistic text, said that the gates of wisdom were going to open up. And as we're going to discuss, different people had different reactions to what exactly that would mean. There wasn't any clear revelation in the year 1840. But what made Ishbitz so unique and what became the inspiration for all of the conversations that we have is the idea that with transition, with trauma, with chaos, with dissonance, with all of the questions that arise out of the world that we live in, there also comes opportunity. And opportunity doesn't come despite challenges. Opportunity comes because of challenges. And I think that's the world that was opened up in 1840. It was a unique world that saw the challenges of the modern world, not exclusively as, and there were plenty of challenges, undermining religious commitment and religious identity and all of that stuff. But there was another way to look at all of that rupture and see the possibility to confront and think about questions that we never had the opportunity to consider. And I think that's why underneath all of the ideas, I chose this rather ridiculous name. And we chose it, I actually like that we chose it with half numbers, half letters. It's kind of bifurcating those two worlds, that sequential numeric world that's very rational and everything adds up and follows very sequentially, that more narrative world, like we spell it on our website or anything, 18 is 1-8 and 40 is spelled F-O-R-T-Y. It's that combination of letters of numbers, the combination of narrative and building stories and ideas and wedding that with that cold, sober world of numbers, that 1-8 that begins our name with. And it wasn't just Ishbitz that was affected by this. I know my dear friend, Reb Joey Rosenfeld, who we have had on this podcast earlier when we were discussing mysticism, he wrote a rather remarkable article about Rabbi Shlomo Elyashiv, Rav Shlomo Elyashiv, who's known as the Leshem. So he was born in the year 1841, this Joey pointed out to me. And he doesn't write it explicitly, but he does write about the significance of 1840. And the Leshem, who was the grandfather, many of you may know his grandson, Rav Elyashiv, who was a major halachic leader in really all of world global Jewry, but lived in Israel and Eretz Yisrael for many, many years, and we lost him a few years ago. But his grandfather, Rev Shlomo Elyashiv, the Leshem, was born in 1841, and he quotes Rav Yisrael Salanter as follows, and I'm quoting from this amazing article that Joey wrote, "And permission has been granted to all those who engage this wisdom to understand these ideas," talking about mysticism, "each according to their level. And specifically from the year Tufresh, 1840, and onwards, as is written in the Zohar, in the 600th year of the 6th millennia, the gates of the higher wisdom, Chachma Ilai, were opened. And what the Zohar meant in writing opened, this means to say that permission has been granted to all those who yearn to cleave with the living God, to engage in Chachmas HaEmes, in true knowledge, to enter and utilize the name of God properly. And anyone who delves into this matter will be enlightened and find that this was not the case before the year Tufresh, 1840, because then it was still hidden and closed, except for a few exceptional individuals. So have I heard," this is Rav Elyashiv writing the Leshem, "in the name of the Gon and Chassid Rav Yisrael Salanter. And all of this is rooted in the revelation of supernal light that is revealed above and egresses below as it draws into this world, Olam Hazeh, additional light, and the secrets of Torah were revealed in order to rectify the world for the eventual rectification." Now that seems very lofty and quite mystical, but it animates so much of what we are doing here. We're able to ask, confront the questions, however difficult, however troublesome, we don't shy away, and we realize that Torah, however challenging, however difficult, however much people may prevent us from developing a relationship with religious commitment and religious life and with Judaism and with Yiddishkeit, however all those difficulties may seem, there is a unique opportunity in this moment, today, in the year 2020, still inspired from those gates that opened up in that tumultuous year of 1840. We chose a very strange name for this initiative, and I want to share a little bit of the Torah and inspiration for why on earth you would name an initiative after a calendaric year. Of all the things in the world, what excites people is not the mid-1800s. When you say the word 19th century, that's not usually what excites people about their Jewish identity. It excites me, but it doesn't excite most people. And I want to share a little bit about why this year, and 1840 in particular, actually means a great deal and stands at the center
in many ways of my Jewish identity. And I think in many ways, collectively, as a people, wherever we are in Jewish life, we are repeating many of the same questions and challenges that had once appeared in the year 1840. I want to begin with a New York Times review of what is really a brilliant book by Orlando Feiges called The Europeans. The review starts as follows. Imagine a society where within the space of a single generation, human innovation all but collapses the most formidable geographic distances, allowing individuals and information to travel the globe with unprecedented swiftness and ease, where new platforms radically transform the ways in which news, music, books, and art are created and consumed, where media-driven celebrity trumps older modes of authority and forms new elites, endowing famous artists and performers with peerless cachet, where audiences converge in a worldwide culture of sharing and diversity and connectedness join equality and freedom as a shibboleth of Western liberalism, where at the same time legislation struggles to keep pace with technological change, capitalism and consumerism destroy even as they enrich, and nationalism, racism, and xenophobia poison the public discourse, threatening disaster. This is the society Orlando Feiges examines in The Europeans, an international culture that vanished on the outbreak of the First World War. The Europeans, and this is the center of the book, begins by discussing the inauguration in the 1840s of Europe's first international railroad lines. If you read that description and thought that it was describing maybe 2008, maybe 2020, maybe 2019, you are wrong. The imagination of a society where in the single space of a generation, human innovation all but collapses the most formidable geographic distances is not describing the internet, it's not describing modern society, it's describing the way the world changed in the middle of the 19th century in the year 1840. And this was a year that not only the world changed because of capitalism and the way people were connected and the railroads, the Jewish community itself also changed in very significant ways. There is a fabulous book that I would recommend you reading. It's not super hard to find. I bought it fairly cheap. It's called Jewish Continuity in America by Abraham Karp, who was a brilliant historian. I think he was also a conservative rabbi. It's a very, very beautiful book that talks about early American history. And he was asked, and he has a chapter in the book that asked, when did American Judaism, the Judaism that we know today, the Judaism of Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, of different denominations, of different identities, when did that begin? This is what he writes. Initially, attempts were made to fashion an American Judaism. The first attempt at a national religious union had its roots in a far-off anti-Jewish outrage. The so-called Damascus Affair, which was almost a blood libel of sorts, where the Jewish community was accused of killing a young child. Following the disappearance of a Catholic priest there in February 1840, the Jews of Damascus were accused of his murder in order to take his blood for use in their unleavened bread, a classic blood libel. Scores were imprisoned, children were seized and held as hostages, and a wide-scale massacre was imminent. Jewish communities the world over were shocked and aroused, and those who dared organize and speak protest did so. The news from Syria and Damascus in 1840 galvanized the Jews of America into action. The Jews of New York, Philadelphia, Cincinnati, and Richmond united in communal expression of horror, sympathy, and indignation. Participation in a common cause, and so many of us remember what it feels like to have that self-conscious Jewish unity. A Jewish unity that's not instinctual, but a Jewish unity where we're acknowledging the fact that different streams of Judaism and different kinds of Jews are consciously coming together for one cause. Participation in the common cause that so excited the emotions brought the scattered and disparate elements of the American Jewish community together in a communion of spirit and concern. It has been suggested, and this is the key line, that modern Jewish history dates from the Damascus Affair, 1840. Certainly, the American Jewish community had its beginnings as a self-conscious entity in the activity precipitated by the massacre in Damascus. If you think of the last year or two and the anti-Semitism that swept across the United States, there was both a optimism and a sweetness, but also a sadness that characterized the unity, in the sense that it was almost innovative, the fact that we were getting together. It was a self-conscious unity. It was a unity that was deliberately stretching our arm across the aisles. When did that kind of unity begin? When did we become kind of self-aware of the latent divisions that we have throughout our community? The first time this self-conscious unity started, the first time that different organizations kind of came together and said, you know, whose logo is going to be on the flyer and who's going to speak first and can we all be on the same podium and when can we talk together? This began in 1840. 1840 was more than just a year of the beginning of the railroad. It was more than just a year where the Jewish community came together in unity. It was a year, like many years on the Jewish calendar, that actually had some measure of messianic fervor. If you know, the year 1840 is the end of the sixth century of the sixth millennia. It's the beginning, if you look at the arc of the Jewish calendar, it's so to speak the beginning of Erev Shabbos. If every millennia is a day, then the entrance into the sixth millennia, the Friday, so to speak, of our collective calendar and our collective consciousness, the entrance into that sixth millennia, the sixth century, 5600, is the year 1840. And in the Zohar, in Parshas Noach, it says as follows. This is from an article by Israel Bartel, Messianism and Nationalism, Liberal Optimism versus Orthodox Anxiety. He says as follows. A new age began for our nation in the year 5600. With both its material and spiritual events, those who reckon the end of days had been waiting for that year. That year had already been singled out precisely as if in a prophecy in the Holy Zohar. Who is writing these words? Thus did Jacob Lifshitz, Yaakov Lifshitz, one of the most prominent Orthodox activists in the Russian Empire, the author of Zichron Yaakov, The History of Jews in Russia and Poland. But let me just say two quick, interesting vignettes about Yaakov Lifshitz that happened to be absolutely fascinating. Number one, Yaakov Lifshitz was the secretary. He was the right-hand man of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. He was the handler, so to speak, of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was the singular Gadol Hador, the recognized central leader of the Jewish community. So he was like that right-hand man. He was a very right-wing person. And there's a funny letter that the Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, writes, where he says, I wrote a letter to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, but the problem is these days, you don't know who's responding, if he's going to respond or one of his handlers is going to respond. He's referring to Rav Yaakov Lifshitz, who was his handler of sorts. You know, when you write a major email to a leader of an organization, a leader in government, you don't really know if the response you're getting back is from that actual person. He was that right-hand man. Second fun fact, for those who love right-wing Haredi media as much as I do, the paper of record in the Haredi community in America is, put in the chat if you want to guess, it is called the Yatid Neman. The Yatid Neman is the Haredi newspaper of American Jewry. The Yatid Neman's editor-in-chief is an amazing communal activist named Pinny Lifshitz. Pinny Lifshitz is Yaakov Lifshitz's great-grandson. Fun fact for those Yatid Neman fans out there, I know there are hundreds. I don't know if they're all on the call right now, but I know you're out there. So Yaakov Lifshitz read this Zohar, which spoke about the significance of the year 1840, and he actually wrote in this Sefer, which I have, Zichron Yaakov, and he actually dismissed it. I'm going to skip to this paragraph. The apocalyptics calculated that this year was the time set for the redemption, according to the tradition. As with every other year concerning which there are allusions to the end of days and redemption. And there were other times that the Jewish people thought they were going to be redeemed, which because of the sins of the generation, that did not merit redemption because of a time of untoward events, disasters, and evil decrees, so too they calculated that the year 5600 was a set time, and its many untoward events and disasters are well known. What he points out to is that in this year, he actually identifies all of the technological innovation, and he dismisses it. He says, this isn't really such a remarkable year. This has been a terrible year. Jews are leaving religion faster than ever. Jews don't care about their identity. Jews don't care about Torah. Jews aren't thinking about God. And we're being subject to unprecedented anti-Semitism. And he takes a very pessimistic point of view about the significance of this year. Maybe it was significant, but because we messed up so much, because people are so rowdy, people are so rebellious, so there's not going to be a redemption. There's not going to be anything special about this year, 1840. But there were other approaches to this year as well from within the Jewish community. And those of you who know me well know that the person and the thinker in my life who has had the largest influence on my life is a thinker known as Reb Tzadok HaKohen Meluvlin. Reb Tzadok was born in 1823 and he died in the year 1900. Reb Tzadok was not raised in a Hasidic home. He was raised as a traditional analytic Talmud scholar. We have Responsa that he wrote, two volumes of Responsa called Teferis Tzvi. And he became a Hasid in his late adolescence in the court of Ishbitz. His Rebbe was Mordechai Yosef Liner, who is known as the Ishbitzer Rebbe. Now, the Ishbitzer Rebbe has a fascinating history of his own, this Rebbe of Reb Tzadok. He came from three different rebellions from within the Hasidic world. The Hasidic world itself was in a rebellion ushered in by the Baal Shem Tov that basically said you can find God everywhere. He can be found even in the nooks and crannies, even in the rebels, even in the people who are seemingly going against and could care less for God, you could find God there too. And then there was a second rebellion. The second rebellion, many years after the initiation of Hasidus, the second rebellion was the rebellion of Prisciska. The world of Prisciska basically said that after Hasidus became institutionalized, after the Rebbe began sitting at the head of the table, Prisciska said, we're too Rebbe-centric. We're too focused on the leadership. We have to be focused on the Hasidim. The story that I love, which kind of encapsulates the novelty of Prisciska Hasidus, is that somebody one time went to a Rebbe and he said, Rebbe, I want to start my own Hasidic movement. And the Rebbe looked at him and said, what on earth gave you the idea that you should start your own Hasidic movement? He said, every single night I have this very vivid dream. And in the dream, I'm sitting at the head of the table, and it's a Fabrengen, and everybody's singing and dancing, and I have all of my Hasidim, all of my followers lined up, hundreds of people, and they're all singing along with me, and I'm having this dream every other night. It must be that I'm ready to start my own Hasidus, to start my own Jewish revolution. And the person pinched him on the cheek and said, Bubula, you don't start your own Hasidus when you have a dream that you have 300 Hasidim. You start your own Hasidus when 300 Hasidim have a dream that you're the Rebbe. There's a difference between starting a movement because you have these grand visions of you being the leader, and there's a difference between a movement that comes bottom up where the followers, where the people envision for themselves a movement that's going to gather and collect them all together. That was the world of Prisciska. It says we don't need a Rebbe at the center. The great student of Reb Simcha Bonim of Prisciska, who was a professional, he was a pharmacist, was somebody named the Kutzker. There are a lot of amazing books about the Kutzker, and the Kutzker Rebbe, Reb Menachem Mendel Morgenstern, was the Rebbe of the Ishbitzer. But the Ishbitzer studied with the Kutzker Rebbe for 13 years, and then he broke off and started his own Hasidic movement. The year that he broke off and started his own Hasidic movement was the year 1840, 1839, 1840, when he started his own movement. And on that Simchas Torah, he decided that he wanted to start his own movement. The issue he had with the Kutzker was an issue of You could break it down in a few different ways, but the way I would explain and the way I've heard it explained is that the Kutzker was running on the express track. He was the A train. He wanted the elite who were ready to scream at the top of the mountain, sacrifice everything, and dedicate their lives to God. And the Ishbitzer looked around and said, no way, no how. We need a local track. We need a track that explains the beauty and the significance of Jewish life for people who aren't ready to go all the way to the end of the destination, to ride the A train all the way from 125 to 59th Street. You got to have smaller stops for people who can get on board and become a part of that movement. And if you look at the introduction that was written by the Ishbitzer's grandson, the famed Hasidic scholar of Gershon Henoch Leiner, who was famous for, he was a scientist and a scholar, he writes in his introduction that his father, I'm not going to read it all inside, he says his father at 13 years, where he learned in pain in the Maris Adulam, which is alluding to the cave where David HaMelech ran when he was hiding from Shaul, he's referring to his years when he was studying with the Kutzker. Afterwards, he left and he started his own movement. And he couches that time, and I'll read it, "Behigia hazman v'ruach Hashem heichel lefamo b'shnas sheish meos le'elef hashishi." The time came in the sixth millennia, the end of the sixth century, who ha'eis asher olav ramaz Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai b'zara kavod. It was specifically that year that was alluded to by Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. And the actual words of the Zohar, which I have in Hebrew and in Aramaic, describes a time, and I'll read just right over here in this first paragraph, the Kasher Yavo Elef Hashishi, when the sixth millennia will come, who sowed Havav, is the idea of the Vav. The letter Vav is what connects words together. It's what connects society together. It's what shows that the consilience, the underlying values that bind us all together, that's the Vav. When you put a Vav in front of a word, it connects the word and. U'b'sheish meos elef le'elef hashishi, these are the words of the Zohar, yiftechu shari ha'chachma l'mayla u'mayoros ha'chachma l'mata. The gates of wisdom are going to be opened up above, and the springs of wisdom are going to be opened up below. And this is what the Ishbitzer said, and he said something so interesting. He actually pointed to a time, v'hainu, over here he says, there's going to become a time where Torah, where religious values and the idea of God are going to be graspable. We're going to be able to grasp them and connect with them. And he actually points to the very fact that this is a generation where people are rebelling, where this is a generation where people are questioning authority, where this is a generation where people don't feel tethered to the same norms and institutional structures that they once had. That's exactly why this is deliberately the time to start talking about religious ideas in new ways. Because just like the revolution of the Ishbitzer himself was a revolution about against the institutionalization of the role of the Rebbe, the institutionalization which divides between the masses and the elite. They said this is the right year because this is the year where society itself is being stirred up, where people are asking questions against authority that they never would have had the liberty or the audacity to ask directly. And suddenly we're living in this society. And that was the year 1840. It was a year of great confusion where all of the financial, capitalist, religious, authoritarian structures were turned upside down. Society overturned within a year. The Jewish community began to look at itself in a different way. Unity was no longer instinctive, it was something self-conscious. We were much more self-aware of what divided us. And in order to come together, to have that vav, that and, in the way we associate with one another, it took a little bit of motivation. It took a Damascus affair. But the Ishbitzer looked at this very same year, the Ishbitzer looked at this very same moment, and he said, this is a moment of opportunity. It's not the end of religion, it's the beginning. It's the questioning of authority that is ripe to start engaging people with questions and ideas that otherwise would have been dismissed, maybe by the elite or maybe by the people themselves who couldn't have handled it. And that's why this project to me is anchored in the year 1840. We began a website and you can look at it. I'm more than happy to pull it up. The website is called 1840.org. And it's a website that I hope is going to approach Jewish questions and life questions in a way that haven't been discussed previously. Every month, we're going to have a different topic, and you can look at the initial topics over here. We're talking about Talmud, comedy, leaving religion, and biblical criticism, and we have future topics at the bottom. We're going to be talking about these topics in ways that maybe our traditional organizations weren't necessarily equipped to do, but that's part of the spirit of 1840, is ushering in a freedom and an excitement that allows us to approach questions of our religious identity and our Mesorah in ways that maybe haven't been discussed in this very same way. And I think it's a very exciting time, and I'm so appreciative both to Mitch and really to NCSY for being so excited and for giving the support and patience for this project. I want to end with a quote, and it's a quote that I have in the video. If you look in every month, like let's say the month of Talmud, which we began with, it starts with a video and we have text, we have wonderful text. And then there are these podcasts and interviews with different world-renowned scholars on every subject. And then at the bottom, we have this reading list. But if you look in this opening video for Talmud, which I'm not going to show you right now, there's a quote that I read many years ago from Yuval Harari, the author of the book Sapiens. And I think in many ways, it cuts to the core of the question that we're in right now in 2020. It cuts to the heart of the anxiety of the year 1840. And in many ways, it encapsulates what I think the opportunities of that this initiative will hopefully uncover. He writes as follows: as robots and AI push humans out of the job market, the ultra-Orthodox may come to be seen as the model of the future rather than as a fossil of the past. Not everyone will become Orthodox Jews and go to yeshivas to study Talmud, but in the lives of all people, the quest for meaning and for community might eclipse the quest for a job. Let me be absolutely clear. Yuval Harari is not religious. Yuval Harari is not an ultra-Orthodox Jew. But Yuval Harari, in his book, talking about the large trends of humanity, actually looks to the Jewish community and says maybe they are onto something that others don't see. And particularly in the painful time that we're in now, where words and the feeling of what it means to be essential and non-essential, what it means to have your identity be so wrapped up in your job and in your profession, for the first time, people are asking questions about what gives me meaning in my life. And I know that's the question that drives Mitch every single day and every single infuriating phone call that we have weekly. And I love him and he knows that. But it's the question that I think is at the heart of the religious experience. That can we create a Yiddishkeit? Can we create a Judaism that in the lives of all people, the quest for meaning and the quest for community is going to eclipse that quest for a job? And we're in that time now because we know that society right now is grappling with the level and amount of meaning that a job and a profession and success can provide. And we have something else. We have that quest for meaning and we have that community. And hopefully together with the new ideas, with the new structure, with questioning authority and looking at the way that the world is evolving, not as a sign of doom of the end of religion, but looking at all of these opportunities as just the beginning. Thank you all so much. I'm so excited to share this journey with you together. Have a great night.
So I hope you enjoyed that overview. We have links to all of the articles and sources that were quoted inside. If you want to explore more about the historical year 1840 and all of the challenges and opportunities that came along with that year. I actually wrote an article about this for Tablet, my dear friends at Tablet. I wrote an article called Want to Understand 2020? Look at 1840. And I actually closed the article with the following, and I'll read it for you now. I published this right before the new year of 2020. We're already way deep into January. New year feels like ages ago. But I still think it's relevant today. And this is how I closed that article, reflecting on how 1840 is still relevant at the close of 2020. And here we are in January, and I still think it is relevant now. And this is what I wrote. And so, now that it's almost New Year's Eve and our minds are still set on renewal, let us remember one last teaching as we prepare for the final leg of this terrible, horrible, no good, very bad year. The Talmud, in Tractate Megillah, on 31b, says that we read the curses at the end of the Torah, right before Rosh Hashanah, as a reminder that the year should end along with its curses and a new year should begin with all of its blessings. This year, 2020, as we all know, certainly feels like an apt year for such a prayer. But 1840 is a reminder that blessings don't emerge in a vacuum. They arrive not in spite of generational challenges, but because of the challenges that each year faces. So in that sense, 2020 should end along with its curses and propel us to see the blessings and opportunities that 2021 brings our way. And I hope that's true for all of our listeners, that this 2021 is a year of safety, health, and happiness, that we are tichle shana v'kilaloseha, tichle shana v'kilaloseha. We close the previous secular calendar year with all of its curses, and we are begin a new year ubirchoseha with all of its blessings. So thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any episode, please subscribe, rate, and review. Tell your friends about it. It really helps us reach new listeners and continue putting out great content. If you'd like to learn more about this topic or some of the other great topics we've already covered, be sure to check out 1840.org. That's the number 18 followed by the word 40, F-O-R-T-Y, .org, 1840.org. You'll also find videos, articles, recommended readings, and tons of other great stuff. Thank you so much for listening, and stay curious, my friends.